Welcome to episode number 41, the real 41 this time. We kind of messed that up last time. Episode number 41 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Stefaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And our guest today, for the second time, is Kevin Bunch, video game historian and documentarian responsible for the Atari Archive series of videos on YouTube, which looks at every Atari VCS game chronologically. We talked about the project at length in a past episode. Don't know which number, but we'll link to it in the show notes. Today, we are talking about his latest video, which is about a game called Stellar Track. But you may know it by its origins as a Star Trek game, which very influential and important and is going to be the majority of what we talk about today. So, Kevin, welcome back to the Video Game History Hour.
It's great to be here. Also, I want to remind all that I am also the chicken owner.
That's true. Yeah. So Kevin is the owner of some very beautiful chickens. And if you are a member of the Video Game History Foundation Patreon, patreon.com/gamehistory.org, at a certain level, you get access to our Discord, where we have a channel dedicated to Kevin's chickens, which is called Kevin's_chickens. Lots of great chicken pictures there, and reports of eggs from Kevin's chickens and how they tasted.
I even had some of Kevin's chickens' eggs. They were taken all the way from the East Coast to the West Coast to me, which was just and I think only one of them cracked on the way, which was pretty impressive. So
Kevin's chickens and their eggs are stuff of legends.
Yeah, exactly.
In the video game historian community.
Good birds. Good there birds good all. Birds. But yes, here to talk Star Trek.
We could talk chickens.
We could talk chickens for an hour, but we won't. Kevin, congratulations, by the way. This is your 50th episode of Atari Archive.
Yeah, it only took, God, was it 4 years now? But
so how many, let's see, how many games are there in, I mean, I know there's no real answer to the question, how many games are there in the Atari
right, and
library?
When do you cut off, right?
Yeah, there's from the commercial lifespan, there's like 420 something.
Okay, so you're on track to do this before you die, to finish this before you die, I think, but
yeah, I'll probably
you'll be cutting it close.
I'll probably be lumping in some of those from 82 and 83 into just one episode, just to make my life easier.
So this video, you know, technically it's about a VCS release called Stellar Track, but really, as I alluded to in the intro, really, this is sort of the history of a very early, very influential computer game, mostly known as Star Trek, based on the show. Now, I think everyone knows vaguely what Star Trek is, but, you know, kind of give us a Cliff's Notes version of, you know, what it was and why it's relevant today and you know, to this game project.
Are we talking Star Trek the game or Star Trek the franchise? Okay.
The franchise, the show. Yeah. Like, tell us about the thing that influenced the game.
So Star Trek was an American television show that ran originally from 1966 to 1969 on NBC. It was not super popular in its time, but it did manage to build this very hardcore audience of fans. It had a very specific blend of, you had your sci-fi action, you know, lasers and space battles and all that fun stuff. But you also had very thoughtful script writing and problem solving, a number of fairly well-known science fiction authors and TV writers worked on this show. Harlan Ellison's one that comes up a lot just because his episode is pretty good and he hated how much they had to cut out to fit it on TV. But you know, more broadly, Star Trek was sort of the first major piece of media you could consider, you know, modern fandom. You had people who were really into the show. They were producing fanzines and newsletters, right? And in those, they would write poetry and fan fiction and have fan art, and they arranged meetups and eventually conventions. And even though, you know, Star Trek, the game doesn't really, like, the author of the original Star Trek game, Mike Mayfield, he was not really involved in any of this stuff, but it's sort of in the same vein, if you will, of wanting to just interface with this, you know, TV series more broadly. And I guess it should be worth noting that after Star Trek ended, it went into syndication, where it was much, much more popular. For whatever reason, you know, just being shown on TV all hours and all different channels did a lot of good for getting eyeballs on it.
I mean, there are still Star Trek conventions today, which is kind of wild for a piece of media this old.
Yeah, I mean, there's still Star Trek TV shows today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They keep going with it.
There's two of them right now, in fact. You know, I think it's important to dwell on that a minute, just because Mike Mayfield, you know, maybe wasn't one who would consider himself part of the fandom, but I think it is that fandom that creates the environment in which someone does fan work, like a Star Trek game. And there was certainly fandom before Star Trek. There probably was focused fandom. I mean, I know, for example, that there were, you know, comic fanzines and conventions that predate the existence of Star Trek. But I think you may be right in that this is the first franchise that generated its sort of own, cultivated for this franchise only sort of fandom, right?
It's sort of rather than like sci-fi in general.
Right. And like, of course, people would be fans of specific franchises, but I think this might be the first time that like a specific thing had its own con and had like the people who were invited just for that thing invited out to the conventions to speak and stuff like that. And, you know, I think a lot of it is probably due to the diversity of the show.
Yeah. This was one of the earliest American TV shows to have, you know, people of color in positions of authority. You know, the Nichelle Nichols character Uhura was really a trailblazer. You had a Russian character on there. You had an Asian American character played by George Takei, Hikaru Sulu. You had three Jewish actors on this show, and while their Judaism did not really come up, you know, in the show itself, there are aspects of, you know, the program, like the Vulcan salute that the character Spock does. You know, that is a Jewish hand gesture that Leonard Nimoy learned as a kid because he was Jewish, and he's like, well, we can do this.
So tell us about Mike Mayfield. So Mike Mayfield is the author of the first Star Trek game that sort of spawns the plethora of them that lead us into Stellar Trek, right?
Right. So Mike Mayfield, he was a teenager around 1971. He was, you know, finishing up high school. He and his friends were big fans of watching Star Trek in syndication. He also lived right near the UC Irvine campus, so he could, you know, bike on down over there and hang out on the college. And he managed to steal, his words, a computer lab access, like, ID. As I remember from the interview, it was with someone he knew who, you know, got a pass to use the computer lab, but ended up not really needing or using it. So he just gave it to Mike because Mike was interested in computers. Mike was trying to teach himself how to write in the basic computer language. So that's the main thing he was doing at the computer lab. But the other thing he was doing there was playing games. So the lab apparently had a PDP set up with Space War. They had a Sigma 7, and they had a couple other games on there, like the original text Lunar Lander game from 1969. And these were sort of his first experiences with computer games. And he thought to himself, I want to write something too. You know, Space War is super cool. maybe I'll do a space-themed game, and because me and my buddies are all into Star Trek, we'll make a Star Trek-themed game. The problem was that he did not have access to the PDP-1, or 10, I think, whatever. Didn't have access to the PDP. He had access to the Sigma-7 and its teletype, which, you know, in the video I show a photo of it, but a teletype is basically a combination printer and keyboard. So you're typing in what you want the computer to do, and it'll print up the text back to you on a ream of paper.
Yeah, so we've talked about teletypes a little bit on this show before, but just as a reminder, this is something that does not have a screen. It can only type back at you in actual paper.
In this case, you would, you know, essentially type where you wanted to travel or type, you know, where you wanted to shoot your torpedoes or whatever, and then it would slowly type out the like the results of what you did, right? That is sort of the game experience.
Yeah, and everything had to be in ASCII characters because, you know, you can't do graphics on a teletype. You can only use the characters there. So this is what he had to work with, and him and his buddies were brainstorming, you know, okay, what can we do with this? And the ideas that they had, he doesn't remember all of them, but he remembers distinctly that they wanted something where you'd have to explore a galactic map. They wanted something where using your weapon systems would drain your energy supply, so you'd have to be mindful of, you know, your resources, more or less. And yeah, they wanted it to be an action game. So what they came up with was this Star Trek game that Mike Mayfield spent a few months typing in on the Sigma-7. And because his access didn't allow him to save to the network, he had to print it up, his code, every single time he was done for the day and take it back home with him and all that fun stuff. When I talked to him, he said he might actually still have some of these code listings like buried in his garage somewhere. I'm like, could you look for them? And he's like, I really don't want to.
But we want to play your unfinished buggy versions.
Right? But
well, we don't even have the original, do we?
No, the Sigma 7 version is not the one that got widespread. I guess we'll touch on that momentarily.
Yeah, we'll get there later for sure.
But do you want me to just sort of describe how his version of the game?
Yeah, how does it play?
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of like a roguelike almost, like very early proto rogue style game, because when you start it up, it randomizes the galactic map, which consists of, I believe it's an 8x8 grid of quadrants, which, you know, the name doesn't make any sense, but that's what he called it in the instructions. So each of these quadrants, when you travel into, is full of, you know, open space, stars, and possibly star bases or Klingons. And Klingons were sort of the, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of the opposing empire in the TV show. So Mayfield decided just to use them as your enemies, your antagonists in this. So the idea of the game is you have a set amount of time to destroy all the Klingon ships in this galactic map. If you run out of energy, you lose. If they blow you up, you lose. And if you run out of time, you lose. So there's a lot of lose conditions and only this one win condition. And traveling around uses up time. Firing your phaser weapons at them will use up energy. And the further away you are from them, the less powerful those will be. You have photon torpedoes, which you have to target yourself and will always destroy the Klingon ship, but you know, you only have a certain number of them. You can actually set how many in the basic code. And you can find these star bases and you visit them and they'll resupply you with energy and torpedoes, but you know, their placement is also random, so you might end up with a seed where they're just in an incredibly inconvenient place. And that's basically the game, and it's all printed up on a teletype. You have different commands. You can do a short-range scan of this quadrant you're in. You can do a long-range scan of all the surrounding systems. You can warp around and choose your shield energy levels, all that fun stuff. But this is a lot of stuff to keep track of for a 1971 video game. Like, This is surprisingly complex design.
Well, in my head, I'm just thinking about the memory capacity of a PDP computer, like any of them, really. And it's like, that seems like a lot of stuff to keep track of in memory.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, I'm not a programmer, so I don't know how exactly he pulls this off, but, you know, this game, you know, looking ahead, it gets ported around to a lot of systems that have very little memory capacity, and it runs. So,
yeah. So you know. That was where I wanted to go next was, you know, I mean, he makes this game, and he's just kind of using the terminal at this college. He doesn't even attend to do it. How does this game start to spread?
So originally he finishes the game by the end of the summer. You know, he takes home a copy of the finished code for himself. He spreads it around to anyone else at the computer lab who's interested. He said that there were quite a few people at the lab who were fans of his game, so they wanted copies for themselves. And, you know, he started going to college. I think he was going to UC Irvine. And, you know, nothing really happened with that until the next year when he wanted to get an HP 35 calculator, which had just come out. Is one of the first relatively affordable and portable calculators. It was a hot ticket item at the time. And he finally got this. And he was at the HP sales storefront, and he was talking about his Star Trek game, and the people there were like, oh, hey, we have these HP 2000 computers now. They have their own version of BASIC. Would you be interested in porting your game to our HP BASIC program library? It'd be public domain and other people could access it. And he said, sure. So he went through. He basically rewrote the whole thing because HP BASIC was very different from Sigma BASIC. And cleaned up a lot of the code, apparently. By this point, he knew BASIC enough that it wasn't just a bunch of spaghetti lines.
And so was he, because, I mean, you said it went into the public domain as, you know, there wasn't really like an industry for selling programs back here. But I mean, was he paid for any of this? Did he get any sort of benefit, or is this literally just kindness of his heart spreading his game around?
That would be it. Yeah, he never got paid for this. And,
wow. You
know, he thinks it's really cool that it's spread around and that people really like it. But he's like, yeah, you know.
It's striking how different that is from the way the game industry ended up evolving, you know?
Right. Yeah, and he did this. He finished the first version in October 72, and according to the file that's online, the final revision of it was put up on their repository February 73. And that's when it started to really spread around, because all of a sudden, anyone who had an HP computer, which was a pretty good chunk of the market at that point. It was sort of between them and DEC, who, you know, they have the PDP and everything. They kind of split the market at that point in the early 70s. So this was basically half of that. And then the folks at DEC came across it. I talked to David Ahl about this, who went on to found Creative Computing Magazine. But at the time, he was working at DEC. And I forget the names off the top of my head of the people who found it and brought it to his attention, but he thought it was really cool. He and some other staffers, they converted it to the DEX version of BASIC. They put it up on their program repository.
So now it's everywhere.
Yeah, and now if you have a computer, you can access it. And then as sort of the last big factor here is that eventually, he put out the 101 Basic Computer Games book. I think that was 73 or 74, the first revision. And that had Star Trek in there under the name Space War, which he says in retrospect was a really poor idea on his part. But he didn't have the
Star
Trek.
That's not confusing at all.
No, not in the slightest. And he's like, yeah, we didn't have the Star Trek rights, but, you know, I probably could have picked a better name, but...
Well, to be fair, I think there's not like the second A or something in there. It's like Space War.
Yeah, there's only a certain amount of characters they could have, so it's like cut down. But yeah, that was the version that really got spread around, because that book sold, I think, 10,000 copies at a time where there was probably that many people with a computer.
I was about to say, that's about all the computers. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he does eventually correct that, right? He gets yes. named Super Star Trek.
For the second version of the book, which he published, you know, himself outside of the Deck ecosystem, before it came out, he was actually able to talk to Gene Roddenberry and told him about the game. And Gene's like, well, I could probably get you the rights to use the name in your book. Let me go talk to some people at Paramount. And sure enough, he got David Ahl permission to use Star Trek as a name in his second edition of Basic Computer Games. Free and clear.
Yeah, and again, free of charge. This whole, you know, there is not an ecosystem, like a monetary ecosystem in any of this yet. And so you got to use the Star Trek name for free.
Yeah. and Super Star Trek, you mentioned, that's an excellent story there too, because, you know, by this point, Mayfield had, you know, washed his hands of this game. He was done with it. He wasn't really involved in the story any further. But another fellow, Bob Leadham, who I did speak to, and he was very charming, was talking about how, you know, he and his friends and his coworkers, they had these computers at the place he was working. I believe he was a defense contractor designing, like, missile defense systems. So they had these computer units. I believe it was a Nova. Data General Nova. And they got this 101 basic computer games, and they were trying out different programs, seeing what they were like, and they came across Star Trek or Space War and were really into it. But you know, all of his coworkers were like, oh, this could use some improvements, and he agreed. So he sat down and just made a slew of changes to the program. So, like, he made it so the Klingons could move. He got rid of the quadrant misnomer by just naming each system using actual, you know, names from the show or from astronomy, like constellation names. He made a couple other little tweaks to the game, but so he ended up calling this Super Star Trek, and he wrote to People's Computer Company about it, which was sort of a store in California that had a newsletter / magazine, periodical, whatever you exactly want to categorize it as. And David Ahl saw that and wrote to him directly and had him send a copy of the game to him, which he published in Basic Computer Games, second edition, and in Creative Computing, too. So, you know, between that and the original Star Trek, you had this, you know, pretty wide opportunity for people to, you know, take this game and try and cram it into whatever computer system they had. So, you know, there was a version for the Altair. There was a version written in Palo Alto Tiny Basic, which is for very limited computer systems and uses very little memory. And there's versions for the Bally Arcade and the Cosmac VIP and the Apple II, the Apple I. Just basically any computer you could think of from the 70s and 80s probably has Star Trek on there.
Well, and it even makes it overseas too, right? Like, there's people in other countries converting this too.
Yeah, like, I came across several versions in the UK, which isn't surprising because it's the same language and everything. But it also had a bit of a life in Japan. So while I was researching this, I came across an article in OMZ Magazine. It's for the fans of the MZ computer line in Japan. And I paid a friend of mine to translate the article for me. And it's all about the Star Trek game. And it sort of describes how this game came to be in Japan and why it's cool. And they have to explain Star Trek because it's Japan. And, you know, it's a niche thing in the US, but it's really a niche thing over there.
Did Star Trek air in Japan, or are these people, like, importing?
It did.
Okay.
It did air in Japan. I believe the article said in the 70s, like around 71, they started showing it over there. But there was one guy, Haruhisa Ishida, who was working in the U.S. at the Bell Labs and came across, you know, several different versions of Star Trek. And then when he went back to Japan and was working at Tokyo University in 1976, he made his own version of it called MicroTrek and started spreading that around. And there's several dozen versions of Star Trek I found for Japanese computers. So even though it's not really, by this point, it's pretty far removed from what you had with Mike Mayfield and Bob Leadham. But, you know, it's still part of that heritage. And you look at some of these Japanese Star Trek games, and it's very clearly still a Star Trek game. You still have the map. You still have the Klingons. You still have the, you know, you've got all the major factors.
Well, and they're adding things like the actual character names, in some cases, character portraits, like little pixel Nimoys and stuff like that. Were other games cloned this often? Like, I can think of maybe like Snake would be my first instinct of a game that was sort of ubiquitous at the time on every computer. Maybe, like, do you know?
I can't really think of any. I think Snake is probably as good as you're going to get, but because the hardware requirements were so low for Star Trek, and there were, you know, frankly, not that many games at the time. Like, I feel like this might be one of the most widespread games of its day. Mayfield, at the very least, thinks it's the most widespread computer program, other than Hello World, the little basic demo.
Like the Hello World of an entire computer game.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he's right, but he's probably not too far off the mark.
I think Doom eats its lunch.
Oh, that's true. Doom is all over the place now. But, you know, hardware requirements have changed for Doom. And people are still porting Star Trek to things today. Maybe not to printers, but...
Doom got ported to a pregnancy... What do you call that? The thing that says yes or no, you're pregnant. What is the word I'm looking for?
Pregnancy tester.
Tester. That sounds right.
Well,
that's true.
I mean, my brain got infected because Kelsey and I just got back from Chicago. We've seen each other every day for like 8 straight days or something. And when you're hanging out with Kelsey Lewin and other people, the Wonder Swan comes up a lot. And
I don't know what you're talking about.
And therefore, something that Kelsey has in her Wonder Swan collection comes up called Mama Vite, which is a pregnancy tracker. So it's really hard for me to not say pregnancy tracker.
I'm glad that's the exact same problem you were having. Like, that was exactly what my brain was doing. And I think it's because I'm sitting across from my Mama Vite, but I guess just closeness to me in general made that same weird word infection. Anyways, Doom got ported to a pregnancy tester somewhat recently, which was very entertaining. I don't think that those are probably very technically intensive products, but what do I know?
The question is, how playable is Doom on a pregnancy tester? Like, can you actually fight a cacodemon on there?
I think they have it like auto playing or something, if I remember right, which, you know, it can't really do with Star Trek, I guess. But with Doom, you could have, you know, like, it's enough to show someone like running around in the levels on autoplay or something. Go, yep, yeah, that's Doom. Yeah. So you do get into this game's widespread on the Bally Arcade in your video, because of course you do. So when we're talking about the Bally Arcade, you know, what is it we're talking about, and why were there so many homebrew games for it?
So the Bally Arcade, it was a game system published originally by Bally and later Astrovision, Astrocade.
It is the Wonder Swan of Kevin Bunch.
I was just about to say that.
it came out in 78. It was not very popular. I would be shocked if they even broke 200,000 units sold. But the people who were into it were really into its capabilities as like a development system. So the Bally Arcade got a couple different basic cartridges, basic computer language. And unlike programming carts for the Atari or the Odyssey 2, these have a cassette interface. So you can just save your program and load it up onto a cassette, and people would sell these, and people would print up or send in, rather, their type in code listings to newsletters and such, and they'd advertise their games and whatnot. So
it's really just another computer platform kind of deal. I mean, the reason it's ported to this is just because it's another place to port it, much like all the other computer types.
Yeah, it's just very unique because they're porting it to a game console.
Right.
I mean, you're programming in with the little keypad that you use to like choose how many lives you want when you start a game. So.
Yeah, that sounds like a pain in the butt.
Oh, it's horrible. I tried to type in a program on there and said, screw this, I'm just going to type in this program on my computer and convert it. But so yeah, one of the Star Trek games on the Bally is that I show in this video is one that I had to rescue from purgatory, because it was a type-in listing that a guy sold around 1979 through a newsletter. He also was selling it on cassette, but none of the cassettes have turned up. And frankly, I'm shocked that the type-in listing showed up. I think he might have only sent it in to the guy who did the newsletter as like a courtesy, and that just happened to be one of the papers he held on to, along with all his other Bally documents, and those are all been scanned online. But yeah, no one had touched any of these type-in listings in the 20 years they've been online.
Oh, so it was online. This isn't from a physical archive. You found this online?
Yeah, it's on the BallyAlley.com website. So,
But were you were the first person to actually go through typing it in and showing it?
Is that okay? Which took a couple of tries to get it to like actually run right, because it's super easy to mistype something on Bally Basic, and then you have to start all over.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that no one had done it yet. I think that's pretty common, actually. I think a lot basic games are not out there yet, and that includes stuff like the NES. There are official basic programs that like Hudson made for the NES that just no one's like captured the tape and converted to a file yet. That's pretty common, really.
Yeah, I know there's a guy who's been working hard on trying to get those Famicom basic tapes and get him dumped, and also started typing in some of the listings from some of the Japanese computer magazines. But yeah, there's a lot of programs and he's just one person, so there's only so much progress.
Man, that's a common thread in this line of work.
Yeah. But I think the bright side of that is that there's still a niche for you to find, folks.
Yeah.
Like if you are interested in preserving history, just look for, it's what we do at the foundation. Just look, identify the holes and fill them, such as, Famicom basic stuff or even just the Bally basic stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of type-in programs from the 70s and 80s that are just stuck on paper.
Yeah. So, okay. So take us to the VCS version. Historically, maybe it's most interesting as being, the first maybe widely available commercial go to a store and buy it version of Star Trek. Is that accurate?
I think that's about right. I mean, there were outlets to buy the game. You could buy it for like the Apple II through, I think, Apple themselves, but you'd have to go to like a specialty store for those.
You couldn't walk into Sears, literally.
Yeah, this was a
buy
Sears
it in a box.
This was a Sears exclusive VCS game, and you could just go in, pick it up for I think $20, and enjoy a surprisingly fun and robust version of Star Trek on a platform that is really, really not built for it. Because, the VCS is not built for, complex strategy games. It's not built for text-heavy games, but...
built for text in general.
Yeah, but Rob Zitabel made it work.
I want to explain, I think at the very beginning of your video, or maybe it's in the description or something, you say that you need to like watch the video at 60 frames per second for the flicker. And that's because that's how the text works, right? Like how making the text appear on the screen correctly works. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's alternating each line of the text and the graphics. So this was originally... a kernel for displaying text that David Crane wrote. It was used by Warren Robinette for basic programming and by Rob Zitabel for Star Trek. yeah, because it's alternating all these lines, if you're just looking at it, you know, in a normal YouTube playback frame per second, it looks like nonsense. It's impossible to make sense of what's going on or what anything is supposed to say. But if you look at it on a CRT or at a full 60 frames on a playback, it looks very good. It looks legible on a CRT. You know, the phosphor fade is so slow that everything looks like it's holding together.
You don't really see the flicker on a CRT.
I mean, like, it's there, but it's pretty minor. It's not as bad as, like, you know, the Pac-Man flicker.
Right, right.
But
and we did have an episode with Gary Kitchen to talk about how difficult it is to get, like, anything at all on a VCS, let alone text and a strategy game. I mean, were there strategy games on the VCS before this? Is this, like, the first one that's...
I mean, there's like chess and checkers, right. Okay. And there's board game strategy,
sure,
games.
Okay.
There's nothing like Star Trek strategy game.
Yeah, and even then, I mean, the system has to really think to make its move against you. Like, it literally has to sit there and think. So it's not really suited for this kind of game. So we would encourage you to go check out the video for various reasons, but one of them being just, when Kevin is showing footage either of Stellar Track or even just the basic programming cartridge on the Atari, just pause the video and look at what a frame looks like. And you'll kind of see what we're talking about how each frame they had to just draw part of the letter. But when you're playing 60 frames a second, it's now legible. And that's just how it had to be done. I mean, and in fact, in recent years, I think people have started adapting that technique to make the games look high res. I think I've seen like a Zaxxon homebrew that sort of looks like the arcade game, but as a very flickery thing, so that it can get all the detail in there. It's a fascinating system, the VCS.
Yeah, these homebrew authors have done some truly wild stuff with the various display capabilities of the machine, or lack thereof.
To start with Rob Zittabel and Stellar Track here. How did he discover Star Trek, and why on earth did he decide to try to put it on the VCS?
So he was telling me that he was working at NASA originally, while he was in college, which they had a location pretty close to where Atari was located. And you know, he discovered the Star Trek game there, as well as, I think, another version of Star Trek that was unrelated called Trek 73, which was sort of this narrative one versus one experience. But either way, he played Star Trek. He really liked it. He got offered a permanent job making weapon systems for the military, and he said, well, I don't really want to make programs to kill people, so I think I'm going to go into games. So he went to Atari. They ended up hiring him. He wanted to work on Atari computer stuff, but at the time they didn't really need someone to work on Atari computer stuff. They needed people for the VCS. I didn't ask specifically about it, but I'm willing to bet it was probably around the time that all the Activision people left the company, so they probably wanted more people in there to take their place. At the time, he told me, you know, marketing didn't tell people what to make for games when he first started there. You basically just made whatever you wanted, and it was on them to figure out how to sell it. So he wanted to make Star Trek, so he sat down and wrote Star Trek.
Yeah, I think you say in the video that he said there was no one there to stop him.
Yeah, that is exactly how he worded it to me.
So you say it's a pretty sophisticated version of the game. It's actually like a viable way of experiencing what Star Trek was. Is that true?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's not I would say coming to it from 2021, there are more advanced versions that have been made since, but for its time, it's probably one of the most user-friendly versions. So, like, you know, first he shrunk the map around a little bit. It's not quite as big as it was on the original computer version, which I think he told me that was because of memory reasons. There was only so much he could do. And it's all joystick based. So it's using the standard Atari controller. They had a keypad controller, but barely anyone owned one. So this game was already going to be kind of niche. So why make it worse for yourself? But the joystick controls actually kind of work for it. So like you're pushing left and right to choose what command you want, push the button to select it. If you're, inputting numbers or whatever, you scroll through and pick your specific numbers. If you're jumping to another section of space, if you're some versions of the game, you just put in how many spaces you want to move, and if that takes you into another quadrant, that's how you travel around for Stellar Track. Thankfully, you can choose how many quadrants you want to jump, and then how many little sectors or spaces, which makes this so much easier to play. You have no idea. It's fairly straightforward. Targeting, you aim in one of the eight cardinal directions that the BCS joystick has available to it. In fact, the instructions use that as like your baseline. It's like, oh, here's your joystick. Here's what each direction would look like related to that joystick, which is a nice little shorthand. Every time you start up the game, it gives you a random seed. You can just push reset if you don't like the seed it gives you, until you get something that seems, completable, I guess you'd put it.
Well, didn't you say the manual also instructs you to just reset until you get what you want and then play?
Yeah, it has specific values in the manual. It's like, if you're new to this game, here's what you should probably aim for. You can play a game with very little time and a lot of enemies. It might not go well for you, but you can. And it works pretty well. I mean, even if you lose, you can jump right back in, and it's pretty engaging, which is what I like about Star Trek as a game in general. Like, it holds up remarkably well.
So, not too many reviews of this game. Don't want to call it obscure, but again, it was a Sears exclusive. It wasn't, something that was widespread. One of the reviews, I forget which one, complains that it's a really old game at this point and that it's hard to swallow paying the full price for it. And that is so weird to think about coming out of someone's mouth in 1981.
Right? I mean, it was a 10-year-old game by that point. And, there had been tweaks and advances to it, but at the end of the day, it's still very much what Mayfield had written. And it was kind of showing its age at this point because of Star Raiders, which Star Raiders came out on the Atari computer line around early 1980. And it took the ideas of Star Trek and made them an action game. So, like, you're jumping around to different sectors, but now you actually have to fly around and fight the alien ships, and you've still got asteroids and whatnot to deal with. You're still contending with finite energy resources and the random generation of enemy ships and star bases and everything. But Star Raiders was a really, it was a critical success. It was a, sales-wise, for an Atari computer game, it was a big hit, which is very relative, but it did get cloned to a lot of other computers. I started taking down some of the names of those, but I have not fully compiled that, but it did show up on Commodore 64 and whatnot eventually. And on the VCS, there's three different versions of Star Raiders on there. But yeah, either way, that kind of changed the game. Even when I talked to David Ahl about it, he said that they wanted to sell Star Trek as one of their creative computing label games. But by the time they were going to do that, the stuff like Space Invaders and Breakout and Star Raiders were sucking up all the energy, so it was hard to get people enthused to pay money for Star Trek. And that sort of hit Stellar Track too.
Yeah, so I'm actually curious about that. I mean, obviously that one reviewer, it sort of correctly identified it as just Star Trek under a different name, but because they were missing the license and it was this weird Sears exclusive, like, is that something that everyone noticed? Or, I mean, would you have to have been, like, in the know to understand that this is just a 10-year-old computer game?
I feel like you'd have to be in the know just because how many people had a computer or access to a computer in 1981? I mean, it was more than it was in, you know, 75 or whatever, but it was still not a huge number. But, you know, even coming to it as a VCS game, it's very unusual because it is this strategy game. It's not a Twitch action thing or a gambling game, which is kind of what you'd associate with the VCS at this point. And I do think that not having the Star Trek license did hurt it, because there probably would have been more people who would have picked it up if they saw the name Star Trek. This was, you know, after the motion picture came out, and this is right around when Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II was going to be coming out to theaters. So, you know, they probably could have picked up a little bit of coattails off of that, but no dice from Sears.
Do you know anything about how the Sears exclusivity, or did Rob know anything about how that worked? Like, I mean, was it like they were picking and choosing games after they were made? Like, yeah, we'll take that one. We want that an exclusive, or... I mean, I'm just curious.
Or was Sears maybe like paying for a certain number of exclusive games and Atari gave them the ones they didn't know how to market? Maybe,
right, right.
I mean, you'd think that, but one of their exclusives was Super Breakout. They had that for like a 4-month exclusive. No, I talked to Ron Stringari, who was the vice president of marketing at Atari. Before that, he worked at Sears as a buyer. So he knew, you know, sort of both sides of that deal. And as he put it, Sears always wanted exclusive merchandise, you know, regardless of, you know, what the source was. They wanted to be able to brand their name on it. So once the Atari was starting to really pick up after Space Invaders came out, they wanted some exclusive Sears Atari games. He doesn't remember why those games were chosen. You know, Stellar Track, Steeplechase, Super Breakout, and
They all start with S.
At Submarine Command. Maybe that's all it was. But he didn't remember why those were chosen. But he believes, you know, a couple of them were already done and a couple were, you know, in development, and that's just sort of what they negotiated at. Anyway, that's probably the only person still alive who remembers anything about that Sears deal. So I know the developers who wrote some of these Sears games were like, they were just dumping off stuff that Atari didn't want to sell themselves, but I mean, they would not have been involved in those discussions, so they were probably just, you know, projecting their own concerns about their game onto those.
So what I like about the Star Trek story is that it shows that the games we think of as being influential really were influential. So, you know, it's like Lunar Lander and Space War begat Star Trek. Star Trek spreads everywhere. It begats Star Raiders, which is its own like branching timeline, and it's I don't know. I guess I enjoy when history feels actually clean and understandable,
which is impressive for Star Trek, because there's so many versions of this game out there. And like, when I talked to Bob Leadham, he said that he has a spreadsheet of letters. He even sent me the spreadsheet of all the letters he's ever received about Super Star Trek, because, you know, he put his name in an address when he first, you know, wrote about the game and published it. And he got letters through the 70s and 80s into the 90s. And his spreadsheet even includes the letter I sent him. So into the 2020s. He told me a lot of it was people just asking for advice on getting his game running on their computers. And, you know, at the end of the day, how many of these people went on to become programmers or even work in game dev? He doesn't know. I don't know. There's a lot of people out there from around the world who are writing to him. And, you know, what I find fascinating is that Star Trek sort of hasn't really gone away. You know, there's still people porting it to things, or, you know, making their own variations on it. I pl- I played in the video one for the Commodore 64 that was written in 2001. It's like sort of action oriented, but still has you flying around. There's one that went up on the App Store just last year. That's a port of the TRS-80 version of Star Trek. So, like, you know, there's still interest in this game and, you know, putting your own stamp on it, if you will. And I find that really kind of endearing. You know, it's held up that well that people want to keep playing it and messing with it.
So getting permission from Paramount, using the name in that book, it's got to be the first something. I don't know if it's the first licensed game, right? I don't know if that's fair to call it a licensed game, but it's that's got to be the first something, right?
I mean, I feel like it must. It's certainly the first licensed computer game. You know, I think Fonz right. might have it beat on the arcade side, but I don't right. think there's much else.
It wouldn't be first TV show then either. Dang.
It's the first science fiction property. Yeah,
there you go.
first licensed home game.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
Boom.
We've done it. But I think this does qualify as the first fan game, period, because, you know, eventually yeah. we got other fan games like Star Wars or whatever, but yeah, definitely Star Trek. Like, what else is going to compete with that from 1971? Another Star Trek game?
Right. I mean, there's fandom, like we were talking about earlier. It could, I don't know, someone might have really been into the Fantastic Four or something, right?
But, and like Space War had inspirations from
Star Trek.
Well, no, there was I cannot remember the name of the sci-fi writer, but there were sci-fi novels that inspired that group when they were making it. But I mean, they didn't name it after
right
the books yeah. or the writer or anything like that. It was just like, well, we like space because we like this, you know.
Yeah,
it wasn't yeah. It wasn't an attempt at fan fiction through game, which is what I would call Star Trek,
right?
Although I mean, there weren't a lot of episodes where the Enterprise just warped around to different sectors and destroyed people, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what are you gonna actually do with the Star Trek on a Sigma 7, I guess.
Right, you're not gonna. There's not a lot of diplomacy you could fit into memory.
I mean, maybe you could make like a Hammurabi clone, but yeah, that's something that's always interested me. Is that, you know, we've got so many Star Trek games, like licensed Star Trek games, and most of them do end up just being like the Mayfield game, where you're flying around blowing things up. It's like,
if you didn't know any better, Star Trek the franchise is about, yeah, flying around space and blowing things up.
It's like, you'd think there would be more point and click adventures than there are, but here we are.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
Space
we
shooty.
Destroy any Klingon we see. Kevin, if I wanted to experience Star Trek right now, which version do I play?
So I knew you were going to ask this question. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think Stellar Trek is probably the easiest, just because it's, you know, it's really? Basically on, it's on basically all the all the Atari like collections of games. So like, if you have access to any of those, or even just an emulator, you just load it up. It doesn't require you to fiddle with settings or anything. But my personal favorite, and it is playable on archive.org and like their in-browser thing, is EGA Trek, which is a version from 1988. And that has a lot of the refinements you saw in later versions of the game. So like, there's planets that you can orbit and, you know, send landing parties down to find like resources. There's Romulans, who are another alien species, and they're sort of like a wild card. There's supernovas and black holes that will launch you elsewhere in space or like have a gravitational effect on things you're firing around. Yeah, it's just a very playable version of the game, and, you know, look it up. You could Google it pretty easily and have it come up. And I guess if you have an iOS device, you know, Trek 80 on the App Store is a pretty straightforward way of playing the game if you want just that sort of stripped down TRS-80 experience. And it's free, so that's a plus.
Really feels like someone could just make a pretty version of this, and I haven't seen one yet.
There was one There was one for Visual Basic in the 90s, but I don't know that anyone's like tried to make it prettier since then. I feel like, I agree, someone could do something really nice looking with a modern system.
It's all games are. Every game is just a bunch of ASCII crap at its core, and it's just visuals that make it look convincing as something else.
Actually, that does remind me of an anecdote Mayfield told me. I have it in the video too, but you know, there was a game jam recently about just porting Star Trek to new platforms, and he got asked to judge it, and he thought for himself, you know, like, oh, maybe I should enter this. I wrote the original one. I could probably knock this out in a weekend. And then he started thinking, like, well, I've got so much better technology at my fingertips now. I could make this, like, look really good and have audio samples and everything. Mm-hmm. And then he realized it would take him a whole summer to do that and decided he was just going to stick to judging.
Well, that's a good, you know, I mean, you talked about it earlier in the video that he sort of was prevented from feature creep just because he had no memory to work with. So we had to keep it down to like, you know, 4 pages or whatever of code. So now mm-hmm. now that he's not limited by that, it's so easy for for feature creep to set in and yeah, spend a whole summer doing it.
Which, you know, he's an adult with a job, so that would probably not fly very well anymore.
Well, Kevin, this was fun. Thank you so much for joining us again on the Video Game History Hour. Sure, it won't be the last time. Where can people find you and the Atari Archive series on the internet?
Yeah, so you can find the video series on YouTube. Just search Atari Archive. I'm also have a Patreon to support it under patreon.com/AtariArchive. There's a companion website that I update periodically called atariarchive.org. It's got my release date information and some, you know, articles as I, you know, get around to finishing them up. I'm on Twitter at Ubersaurus. And I think that covers all of those.
Great.
And people can see your chickens in the Video Game History Foundation Discord.
Yeah.
After you back Kevin's Patreon, if you haven't backed the foundations, go do it and come see Kevin's chickens.
Yeah, they're very good birds. You know, a couple of them are very shiny.
What is it, $10 a month? That's a steal. That's a steal for seeing Kevin's chickens. Great. Thank you so much, Kevin. This is great.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunamune and edited by Austin Eller. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.